Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. On this episode, we have crazy news like Lord of the Rings returns. Disney and Hulu and Max are somehow in bed together. And then we rumble through the forest as we discuss the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes spoiler cast. Let's get on with the show. Thanks again for listening to The Hollywood Outsider. This week it is just Troy Heinrichs and myself. We are going to talk a bit of entertainment news, movie and TV news, and then we're going to hop right in to Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. But there's a lot of cool stuff happening in entertainment right now. Troy is joining me for this one. It's just Troy and I for this part. Troy, thank God we got rid of those other ones, right?
I know. This way we can just talk freely and quickly.
Yes, please. We're going to go back to the past again. Because the Oscar-winning team behind the $6 billion blockbuster Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit trilogies are reuniting to produce two new films. The first of the new projects from Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh, and Philippa Boyens is tentatively titled Lord of the Rings, The Hunt for Gollum. And that was just announced from Warner Brothers last week. It's going to be directed and star the Lord of the Rings genius that created Gollum, Andy Serkis. And you're going to get Walsh and Boyens are going to write the screenplay. Now, what do you think about that? You're a huge Lord of the Rings fan. Huge. Huge. One of the biggest I know. Why do they do this?
Because the property is really popular, number one. Two, it keeps the rights with them because if they don't make contact, then the rights eventually revert to somebody else. In this case, Amazon has part of the rights for the TV series portion. Right. And then Warner Brothers obviously having the rights for the film side of things. And so I think what's really great here is that with Peter Jackson coming back on board, we're actually going to get more story because it's expansive. There's just so much in Middle Earth between the first age, the second age, and the third age. The TV show right now is currently taking part in the second age with obviously the movies taking place in the third age. So I think there's a lot you can tell that we can glean from the books and get a general direction where maybe not actually written down as official books from Tolkien. There's a lot of world building and history and backstory and Silmarillion that could be mined. And all of that just leads to very great content for a movie studio to be able to put something out.
All that said, great answer. Are you excited though?
I think so. I mean, the challenge I have right now is that The Hobbit wasn't super great. I mean,
man, it was great till the second movie. The third movie is terrible.
The third movie is terrible. And the third movie never should have happened. And it's honestly part of the book when you read The Hobbit that actually also is very tedious to get through. So it makes sense that the third movie was kind of an issue because that part of the book for me is also an issue. I never understood why we had to have all the men and armies fighting each other when we're really just this little, you know, Hobbit is going to go slay a dragon. That's the story. I don't need to know about the men, right? That could have been a completely separate book altogether.
I would also say a big problem with that one had to do with the CGI, the whole production. They went away from practical effects, went more digital, and I think it just looked terrible. So I didn't have as much of, I mean, the story, yes, I agree. I'm like, well, now you're just recycling Return of the King to some degree, or Helm's Deep or something along those lines. I would much rather have had that story of the Hobbit going to slay the dragon. That was the interesting part to me. But granted, That's not how the Book of the Hobbit ended. I mean, it's the same thing that happened in the book. They just drug it out forever. And
it could have very easily been two movies instead of three.
It should have been. Honestly, you could have made one movie. But I would have was fine with two. And Benedict Cumberbatch, I thought, voiced that dragon magnificently. The design was fantastic. I really loved it.
That's where the whole CGI budget went, was to Smaug.
Yeah, it did. Because then you come back to the third movie and you're like, "What? Where are the effects that were in the second movie? Like, what happened? You just like, you spent all of it?" So it was
glorious though. Let me tell you, Smaug looked really good.
Yeah. But Andy Serkis, he directed a couple movies. He did the all CGI Jungle Book. Which I thought was fairly good. And then he did Venom 2, which I thought was as good as the first one, you know, for what
it's fun to watch. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Worth a watch. I feel like he has the knowledge, right, to make the CGI work. He's going to do Gollum. So you have Gollum involved, which I know will get a lot of fans stoked right off the bat. I have a concern about is, at first I was like, well, so is Gollum going to be the star? Because I don't want to watch 3 hours of Gollum. I just think that would get exhausting to some degree, and poor Andy Serkis's vocal cords probably would be damaged. But it looks like the hunt for Gollum. So people are going to be looking for him, searching for him. I don't know exactly what that story is going to entail, but I think it's interesting.
And I think what people are assuming is that it'll be full CGI Gollum in Gollum's state that we see him at the end of the series.
Yeah,
this probably could be a younger one, literally right after he finds the ring.
Yeah.
When he's still a hobbit.
That could be interesting. Honestly, that would be a lot more interesting than My Precious, you know, for 3 hours.
Right. Yeah, I don't know where this is going to land. I mean, it could be right after he finds the ring. It could be the pursuit of Mordor, and it's actually told more of a dark angle from the perspective of, you know, the Sauron and his army mm-hmm. looking for Gollum in the time between The Hobbit and the start of the Fellowship. That could be an interesting story, too, because we've never seen anything told from the perspective of Mordor and their point of view. That would be an interesting tale to sit with, because you're actually now with the enemy, but them as the protagonists in a way. That could be an interesting tell.
All right. So you're looking forward to this then.
Yeah. I mean, any rings is good rings as long as they honor Tolkien's masterpiece, right? If they just go do it for a cash grab and you could tell that they don't care as fans, like if it was anybody but Peter Jackson and Andy Serkis doing this, then I would be concerned. But the fact that Peter and Andy are back, at least you know there's going to be a level of care put towards it.
And Fran. I don't think Fran Walsh gets enough credit.
Oh, that's true.
For the series. I mean, she's very involved. So I'm looking forward to what they do. I feel like they need a redemption after Hobbit. And I'm sorry if you don't feel that way, but it's true. Because the third movie is terrible.
Some challenges, too, because people are assuming that Peter Jackson and Fran were part of the TV series, and they're not. And so this is kind of a way for them to say, like, hey, no, if you want more rings from us, this is our rings. Don't worry about that Amazon thing.
Yeah, it is weird how the rights got split up, right? Film is one way and TV is another. Weird.
It happens in the business, I guess.
It does. Speaking of TV and business, how about this one, right? Disney, Hulu, and Max are united to bring back cable. They're bringing it back to life Frankenstein style in a way. They're going to create one streaming bundle. That's Disney, Hulu, and their rival Warner Brothers' Max are going to hook up to be one part of one streaming bundle. I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime. I mean, this is kind of like crossing. This is like a move, several movies crossing studios. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's clearly a crossing the streams event that's going to send Gozer back somewhere, because our brains cannot handle the fact that I can buy Disney in the Max app. I can buy Max in the Disney app. But do I need all three apps, or is there going to be one major app?
Oh, one app, man. I think it's going to be one app. I would assume. I don't know that for sure. It's very, very early. But they said it's going to be a bundle. It'll be available for purchase on any of the three streaming platforms' website and offered as both an ad-supported and an ad-free plan. So you can go either way with this.
Yeah, and so let's just think about this, right? ABC, CNN, DC, Discovery, Disney, Food Network, FX, HBO, HGTV, Hulu, Marvel, Pixar, Searchlight, Warner Brothers, and Studio Ghibli. How does that not say extended cable?
I mean, it is, because what wasn't getting reported very much is there's also a sports bundle coming. Disney and Warner Brothers joined forces along with Fox Corp to launch a streaming sports bundle, which is also slated to debut this fall. It's like they're trying to bring Fetch or Sexy back in the form of cable. Right?
And what I can't understand about this concept is, where does the split go? Is it a 50-50 split? Is it a 70-30 split? There wasn't details on the deal itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that's the most interesting, because is this Zaslav just riding the coattails of Bob Iger? Is this Bob Iger saying, we understand how to do streaming now, so this is Bob Iger's big return and big move in order to, like, you know, reestablish dominance, because he's already said, you know, with the MCU news, right, that they're going to try to parse back content delivery because we've done too much. Now here we're basically saying, hey, let's bring in more content. So it's kind of an oxymoron in a way, but
kind of. But I mean, the streamers have had that add-on ability for a while, you know, where you can add on different streaming options. You know, Amazon, you can add on Showtime. You can add on Paramount Plus. You can add on Max or whatever. Like, that's been there. So it's just bringing it to full fruition, I guess, to like the full visual.
And this makes it one step away from truly being cable again, because when you think about Amazon Prime, I can buy Max on Amazon Prime. I can buy Paramount on Amazon Prime. I can buy MGM Plus on Amazon Prime. What's to say that I buy this new bundle on Amazon Prime? And then I have everything in one place. And then it's really Prime versus Apple TV versus somebody else for the, you know, cable operator, quote unquote.
Still the best part of this, though, is... No ads. We talked about this last week. You can still get a no ad version. And also, you can still, I mean, this was always the advantage of streaming, is you could pick, right? You could say, I want that one. I don't want that one. I want that one. I don't want that one. So you can still choose what you want. So you don't have to have the full cable where I paid $100 a month and I get 80 channels. I only want 5. Now you can just get the 5. So that still exists. So it is still a better offering, I think, to cable, as long as the pricing stays relatively slim.
Yeah, unless you are at that point where it's like, well, I need this for this and this for this and this for this. And they purposely put content on specific things so that there's always a cycle of you paying for something.
Yeah, but I'm telling you right now, I can look at this picture and go, okay, I'm going to need 3. I'll need Netflix. I like Netflix. I know some people are up and down on that one. Prime, I'll have it for the shipping more so than the actual video content. I just like the shipping. So I'll already have that. And then you get the Disney, Hulu, and Max bundle, and everything's covered that I want to see. Yeah, I won't be able to see Paramount Plus, but I'm sure I can borrow somebody longer or something.
And right now, Paramount Plus has been my go-to for the most part, me personally. I mean,
isn't that funny? Like, we all have our different preferences.
Well, I mean, Paramount is Star Trek. Oh, it's also Survivor. It's also Amazing Race. It's also Showtime bundled in there.
Totally, and it's also football. I'm totally there. I'm with you.
Yeah. and football's coming. You know, got schedule comes out right about as we're hearing this. So you know who's playing when on football too.
Oh man, some crazy times. Hey, before we move on, I do want to mention, like, Shogun was a limited series on FX, but apparently they just signed Hiroyuki Sanada to star and produce a second season of Shogun, even though it's not supposed to come back. So now it looks like they are going to give it a season 2 because it was so huge. I just want to know how do you feel about that? I know you didn't watch it, but like, if they say it was limited and it ended perfect, why ruin it?
I think that's the same case you can make for Westworld. I think that's the same case you can make for The Ones Who Live, The Walking Dead, mm-hmm. Rick and Michonne show. I thought the ending was fantastic, but at the same time, when I got done with that, I was like, I kind of like want to see some more. You know, I like the characters. Let's go ahead and, if we can tell a good story, let's go ahead and do another season. But I think Shogun needs to do it in a way that Westworld did it, where each season felt contained, that if it did end here, it'd be okay. Even though we all want the 5th season of Westworld.
But. Oh, we do. I want to see the original plan end.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm fine if they do that. If it ends up being like another period of time or another story or something like that, I just don't want it to be like, this wasn't the ending, actually. That was a great end. I know you haven't seen it, but it has a great ending, and it feels very much like it captured the story I needed to see. If you want, there's other books, do one of the other books or something, different periods in time. I don't know, but I just don't want to ruin. I've seen this happen too many times. You and I have seen this happen too many times.
You get something good and then you do more and it ruins what was good.
God, absolutely. I'm going to take the mic from Troy for a minute. He's not really a big Crow fan, but I am a huge fan of the Crow. And this week that we recorded this is actually the day we record this is the 30th anniversary of the release of Brandon Lee's The Crow. I know it's getting a remake. Don't care. I'm talking about the original. All right. I'm talking about the OG, if you will. And it was 30 years ago that director Alex Proyas completed and unleashed Brandon Lee's swan song as James O'Barr's The Crow. James O'Barr's the writer of the comic that created this particular character of Eric Draven. And I mean, if you don't know, Brandon Lee was an up and coming actor. He's the son of the great Bruce Lee. And unfortunately, there was a tragic accident on set that took his life. And I mean, it was just, it's one of those things that stuck with me. I was a huge fan of Brandon Lee, or I was becoming a huge fan of Brandon Lee. I'd watched Showdown in Little Tokyo. I'd watched Rapid Fire. I was like stoked for what was next in his career. I had just been watching this guy become an amazing martial artist, become an actor in his own right, and accomplishing some things that even his dad wasn't
going to seemingly accomplish. And unfortunately, this movie took him away from us far too soon. And he died several days before the filming was completed. So they were forced with a choice. Do we want to continue with filming and figure out how we can make this happen, or do we scrap the whole thing? It could go either way. It really could. And honestly, walking into the theater, I didn't even know which direction this was going to go. I didn't know how I felt back in 1994 about, is this really honoring this man who lost his life? I know his family, his mom and his sister wanted this film completed, but is that the right call? I mean, what if this movie comes out and it's horrible, or his performance isn't well received, or whatever the case may be? What if any of these things happen? What is the legacy here? Is it really just a sad tragedy? Leading actor lost his life, and that's about all there is to say about that. Movie didn't do well, etc. This one, I think, crushed it. I think the film surprised me in many ways as we watch Eric Draven return from the grave to avenge he and Shelley's murders and what that means, creating this whole new world. Alex Proyas, the director, built a world in this movie. I mean, you can go ahead and look at so many other films that have borrowed from this visual style. I mean, honestly, I think The Matrix at least owes a nod to it, right? It's just a beautiful, fully realized world that, in much in the same way that the Apes movies does, it creates its own mythology. And it became mythological as the movie went on, as the years went on. Thankfully, we remember this movie as a great performance for Brandon Lee. I think most of the people that have seen it love it. They love the iconic soundtrack, one of the best soundtracks of the 90s. That's a topic we're going to cover pretty soon. I will tell you, The Crow will probably be near the top of that list, if not the top. There's a lot of beautiful performances across the board, aside from Brandon Lee. Ernie Hudson as the lovable cop who is there to help Eric Draven every chance he can. Man, just so much heart, so much depth. You've got Michael Wincott as Top Dollar, the villain. One of the best villains in film, my opinion. Top 10 for me. I just thought the way that he carried himself, his presence, his gravitas, the way that he just caw, caw, bang, fuck, I'm dead. I just love his performance overall. It was terrifying, yet hilarious, yet threatening at all times, yet also kind of endearing in several ways. So I'm still kind of wondering, what the hell is that relationship, right? What the hell is going on there? Anyway, it's a beautiful film. I think it's masterful storytelling and a perfect combination of factors. You have great casting. You have a director who's up to the challenge of creating a whole new world and visual style and bringing comic book movies to life in a very artful way, which I don't think really gets appreciated much. When people talk about The Crow, when you talk about superhero movies, right? People love to talk about The Dark Knight. They love to talk about gritty and that just tangible feel that some of the harder edge comic book movies have. The Crow did it first. Okay. The Crow did it first, did it before Blade, did it before The Dark Knight, etc. The Crow had established this pattern and did it well. It's such a great story. It's so well told. And it's wild how it's endured over so many decades now. 3 decades this film has lasted. And I kind of wanted to just speak to it. I just want to monologue a bit because I love this movie. It's really impacted me. As my kids got older, I watched it with them and it impacted them as well. It holds a special place in their hearts. And it's one of those things that I can always come back to. It makes me feel good in a way. And I don't know why. I think part of it is, yes, the storytelling, yes, the world building, yes, the visual style, yes, the soundtrack, yes, all of those things. But also in a way, it kind of speaks to me on a life after death level. It's your legacy carries on. And the movie has such a twofold punch in the gut because of what happened to the real actor and also what happens to Eric Draven. There's a beauty to it that I think is hard to comprehend. And especially, I don't know how it affects new viewers. I really don't. But if you were of age when this came out or just know the history of it, it impacts you a little bit deeper. It's a little bit more nuanced. It's a little bit more of just a flickering of the heart, if you will. I mean, I watch the movie as the movie. When it gets to the end, I've seen it 100 times. I know it can't rain all the time, but I've seen it 100 times easily. And at the end, when the credits roll, I'm still crying. I'm still sobbing. It still hits me in the heart. And it's always on two factors, on two levels. It's Eric Draven, and that whole story is complete. And it's brutal, and it's sad, and it's horrific. And also Brandon Lee's legacy is tied into that same death. And it's hard, and it's brutal, and it hits me there, too. It's always a two-punch. It's always a two-punch to the gut every time I watch this movie. And I mean that in a positive way. And you know, I know the saying is it can't rain all the time, but I think sometimes you need to focus on the positive because it can't rain all the time. You got to look at the bright side. You got to see the joy in this. The fact that it got made, they completed his legacy. They created a film that has managed to stand the test of time to generations that don't know anything about what happened to Brandon Lee. And I just think it's a beautiful film that deserves to be celebrated. I still watch it every Halloween. I'm probably going to watch it this week, obviously, with the anniversary. And I've never bored of it. I've never bored of it. So I hope you guys are fans of The Crow as well. It's just something that really, really impacted me. And I wanted to kind of speak to it because I know there's a lot of other fans out there that it really, really spoke to. And kind of just embrace the story of love and redemption and, you know, finally reuniting with the one you love, even if it's after death. You know, I think it's a beautiful story and it's dark, it's dour, but man, it hits me every time. Two punch to the gut. Love it. Okay. Well, that's enough of that timeless cinematic classic, as it's proven. All right. Let's move on to Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
You know what? We talked earlier about 1994 and one guy that was prominent in that decade and many decades before, many decades after, was Roger Corman, the B-movie king of the world. And I want to read you what my brother wrote this, right? Because he's a big fan of Roger Corman. He loves B-movie cinema, loves schlock cinema, some called it. I would probably have called it that. That's probably where, you know, the schlock came from. But he was a huge contributor to independent film and a producer of many films. He's a legend in Hollywood. He really is, if you don't know who he is. But my brother said this, not me. I didn't write this. Love or hate his movies, he was still one of the most important people in the history of movies. The large list of talent that he gave a start to is staggering, like Jack Nicholson, James Cameron, etc. He also pioneered the independent film model that proved filmmakers didn't need Hollywood to thrive. And I just think that summed up everything I wanted to say and is absolutely true. If you love independent film, a lot of people that celebrate independent film still look down on Roger Corman. And because he made a lot of B movies or he made stuff that was kind of seen as cheesy and that sort of thing. And that's just not fair. He helped create the model. He made it very important that the studios are not the only ones that can produce quality content. And that's what he went out to prove that could be done. And that's what he proved could be done. And now still thrives to many degrees today. He's a hero in film. So if he didn't like his movies, that's fine. That's fine. I mean, he made some shit. He made some great ones, but he also made some shit. But he plucked talent out. He gave talent a chance. He gave the independent movie making model a chance. He's a very important man in terms of film and where we are today. So whether you like his movies or not, he deserves to be celebrated.
Yeah. And the thing is that you think back to his career, it goes back to the 50s. I mean, like, he's been around for a while, thinking about those old classic, like, drive-in type movies, right? Mm-hmm. The Attack of the Crab Monsters and Not of This Earth. And then, yeah, like you said, done some real big stinkers. What was it? Avalanche was like a $6 million budget and made like $87,000.
Sounds right.
So, yep. Yeah, you take chances when you talk about independent film, and some things hit and some things miss. But Corman was dubbed, I mean, the Pope of pop cinema, the king of cult. Like, these are things that people know him as. And whether you like the cheesy movies or the Saturday B movie type sci-fi type things he did from time to time, He definitely knew how to make a film, and that was the big thing.
Yeah, he did. We lost a legend. Now let's journey into the jungle for the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Now we're going to talk about this real quick, spoiler free. Okay, just so if you know, you want to see it. And then we're going to kind of get into some spoilers about it because it's an interesting way that they took this story. So the new Apes movie is set many, many years after the conclusion of the War of the Planet of the Apes. In fact, they say many generations later, so we don't actually know what year it is. Many ape societies have grown from when Caesar brought his people to an oasis, while humans have been reduced to a feral-like existence. In fact, many of them cannot even speak. They're seen to not speak anymore. They haven't been observed speaking in many, many years.
Which is caused by the, this is all tied back into the original trilogy, not the original trilogy, but the most rebooted trilogy, the virus, right? Alzheimer's cure.
Yep. All tied into the virus. Humans screwed something up. Imagine that. A lot of ape groups have never even heard of Caesar because, again, this has been, you know, many generations later. While others have kind of contorted his teaching to build burgeoning empires. And in this setting, one ape leader begins to enslave other groups to find human technology, while another ape who watched his clan be taken embarks on a journey to find freedom, and a young human woman comes along to help that quest. Now, one thing I will say is right off the bat, in terms of the plot, and I'll come back to it more in the story portion, but I really did like how they, it's almost topical. I'm sure it wasn't, obviously it couldn't have been intended to be topical because the movie was filmed, you know, two years ago, whatever. But it really does bring to the point this everlasting theme of people disfiguring their religious icons for their own purposes. I love that aspect of the story.
Yeah, and contorting the words, right? Some people look at Caesar's teaching in people. Is that the right word? Some apes look at Caesar's teaching in a certain way, as far as like everybody should be peaceful and together and apes and humans can coexist. And other people are looking at Caesar's teachings around apes must not hurt apes. And so this kingdom leader is gathering the apes together to work towards a common goal, you know, so that they could obviously get rid of humans completely. And so even though the concepts are correct, the execution of the concepts are flawed in many ways.
Very much so. But because of that, we have all new actors. We don't have Andy Serkis again. He's too busy getting ready for Gollum's return. So, you know, we have Noah, who is kind of this young apprentice. His dad is the head of the Eagle Clan. What they do is they steal the eagle eggs, which are really hawks, right? Aren't they hawks?
They seem more like hawks than eagles, but
sure do. But you know, if you think they're eagles, fine, your world. Change the name. They take an eagle's egg, and when it hatches from birth, they raise that eagle/hawk to be their protector. They basically train them. They're just like an animal wrangler, right? That's what they are, and that's the whole purpose of their clan. Is they raise these hawks or these eagles. I gotta call them eagles because they call them eagles. They're freaking not eagles. They raise these eagles to help them with food, with and identifying threats, et cetera, et cetera. Like they're a big part of their existence. And then for reasons that don't want to say here, essentially another clan comes through, stomps through, and grabs these people up. Or grabs these apes up. Jeez, they're not people. And takes them back to their compound. And then Noah is the son of the father who has to go after them and try to see if he can save them. That's essentially the plot. And the CGI, fantastic. Acting, the voice talent is very, very strong. Overall, I just kind of want to like encapsulate like overall what you thought of the movie. And then we're going to get into the spoiler portion so we can speak freely. So what did you think score-wise and overall of the film?
I mean, overall, I gave it a 7.5. I thought it was really well put together. I thought that the movie does have a little bit of a lull at a specific point in the middle, but they have to do a really great job of understanding, like, what are we dealing with right now? How far into the future are we? Some are surmising that it's probably 300 years into the future, I don't know if it's been that long, because I don't think that would fit with my thoughts of what happens at the end of the movie, because how do you survive that long? But it's possible, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But the things that I really enjoy about this movie is just the journey that you go on as Noah tries to understand, you know, his surroundings, right? What does it mean to be in an ape community? What does it mean to be a son? What does it mean to be a leader? What does it mean to be a friend to a human and be maybe ostracized by your own people? So that the whole quest and arc of character building and world building and story building for this new potential future of the Apes franchise, that was really well done, because it just builds as the movie goes along to this great, awesome climax. And then you get this like nugget at the end that just is like, oh, wow, this could really go some cool places. And I'm super excited to see where it goes. I think that's the big thing. When you leave the movie at the end, you're going, what's going to happen next? And that's what makes it awesome.
All right. My score is $7. If $10 full price for Mission, I give it $7. I don't think it rises to the level of the first trilogy, but it's a strong start. And I really did enjoy it. And overall, though I agree that there is definitely a lull in the middle, I mean, it almost lulled me to sleep. There's a middle section where it's just not that interesting, I thought. But overall, we're here. So now let's go into spoilers and kind of be able to open this up a little bit. When you talk about the voice cast, let's start there. Did anybody really stand out to you? What I did like about this a lot is, though I kept listening, I'm like, it's got to be people I know. There's really no recognizable voices, which I think helps the film a lot.
Yeah, because you're not hearing the actor. You're looking at this character going like, I don't see anything but Proximus, right? This leader, you know, even though Kevin Durand is voicing, Proximus does like a really great job of exuding leadership, riling up the troops, going for a common cause. And you would assume if it is, say, 300 years later or even 30 years later, how much these apes have evolved in their language styles. Some of them are still very broken. Some of them still use the sign language in conjunction. But in this case, Kevin Durand brings Proximus to life in a way where he just exudes that confidence, and no matter what, no one's going to take him down. And his speech patterns are very well timed, given the fact of his surroundings, because he is being taught by William H. Macy's character and read to, so he's more educated than other apes, which would be the case for a leader of a kingdom in this case.
Yeah, Kevin Durand is the only voice I knew when I looked at the cast list afterward. I was purposely not looking at the cast list because I kind of wanted to be surprised, because I knew a lot of it was going to be CGI. And I didn't recognize him, honestly. And I love Kevin Durant. He's a good actor to watch. So it was kind of cool to know that, oh, all right, you picked a guy with a good voice, not necessarily a recognizable one, which I thought was very sound. And what did you think about this whole Proximus angle, this Proximus Caesar, where you have... you know, you have someone twisting the memory of Caesar, very much using it in their religious context, like we have, you know, overseas. Not like people just, they're always constantly in battle over religion, right? Like people twist the word of God and so on and so forth to justify their actions. And that's exactly what's happening here. He's using the memory of Caesar to justify his attacks, his slavery, his, you know, all of his efforts. Do you agree with that? Do you like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because Eagle Clan, obviously new to the party because they were kidnapped in the course of this film. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, hey, I don't really like what's going on here. But it's amazing to see how just enough truth and enough twist gets your entire community to do something and unite as a common goal, because they love Proximus. They're like, yeah, it is a good day today. Let's go ahead and tear down this wall. And they're just all fired up. So it's very much a symbolism of American politics today in a lot of ways.
It really is. And you know, just for generations of war, sadly, people using, you know, the name of just basically using the Bible to justify a lot of their horrors. And that's what's happening with Caesar's name. And I thought that was interesting that they would work that into the story, that was the way they were going to go. And was it Raqqa? Rocca is the one that understands the real history of Caesar, right? And he's the one that kind of holds that and carries it forward. I thought that was an interesting dynamic, that we still have someone that exists that has been following it for years and years and years, although apparently he's the last one. And whether or not he is dead remains to be seen, right? Because at the end, I think he just washes away. I don't think we see him again after that.
Correct. Yeah. He gets whooshed away by the river.
I still think he's probably alive if there's a trilogy.
That would be my hope, because in this case, Rocca was played by Seth MacFarlane's Orville's commander, Bordas. So if you watch the Orville and you know who Bordas was, Bordas is playing Rocca here. And
Peter Macon.
And it's weird to see that, because like I remember what Bordas sounds like, and then you see Rocca. It doesn't sound anything like Bordas. So again, the voice acting here is just so on point. And Rocca is the orangutan. So one would lend you to think that the reason why he knows so much is because this is probably a descendant of Caesar's orangutan friend from the original trilogy.
Otherwise, Owen Teague plays Noah. I thought that was, he was good. I don't think he really blew anything away. Freya Allen plays May, who's the human, also known as Echo, also known as Nova, right? I mean, there's a whole lot, because we don't know her name until she actually speaks. I don't know. Or was she known as Nova? I'm confused now.
The humans are known as Echoes because they can't talk. And then they dub her Nova until she speaks and gives her proper name, okay, which is May.
Because I'm just looking at the list, and it's like Echo, Nova, how many names May.
Does this person have? Fuck,
pick one. Man, my head hurts. I can't remember. I saw this right before I went on vacation. So what do you think about this human aspect? I actually like that they're being smart. There are still some smart humans out there, and they're playing coy, essentially. They're going to play mute to exact their means, and then only speak when absolutely necessary, and they know that they can trust Noah.
Yeah, I thought that was a really cool angle, because where there might be some cause for concern about the virus and how the virus is spreading, you would assume at this point in time that the virus has either dissipated or mutated enough that there's a way to avoid the virus if you are out in the wild, because we do see some humans that are still wearing like hazmat type suits and are afraid to go outside. Mm-hmm. So there's a challenge here to kind of think through, well, are there humans that are, what it sets up as an interesting plot point of, are there humans that are immune to the virus? Are there humans that are just playing coy and they're not choosing to speak as a distraction technique for the apes? So there's a lot going on there that we don't know a lot about yet in this world. Mm-hmm. So we have to see how that plays out. Like, are the humans truly endangered and can't talk? Or is it a tactic of war that's going to come in the future based on what happens at the end of the movie?
Well, my assumption would be, just like with any virus, right? There are going to be people that have a natural immunity. You know, we just went through this, right? There is definitely going to be people that are not affected by it and have just found a way to survive, but they're playing like they are affected by it because they don't want to be exploited, and they kind of want to play dumb, right? They want to play weaker than they are. And I think that's a tactic that I like a lot for the movie. And I give director Wes Ball some credit for going forward with that. I know he's not a writer. It's Josh Friedman, Rick Jaffa, and Amanda Silver, mostly Josh Friedman, the way I understand it. But the way that they've crafted this world, and kind of like they're bringing humans back into it while also establishing that this is the apes' world now. Humans are just a minor...
an afterthought.
Yeah, an afterthought. But as the movie goes on, what I also love is that it's become painfully obvious that humans, no matter where they are in the the food chain, they still think they should be running things. And that's where May comes in, because her whole plan has to do with getting some technology from this vault, getting it back to humans, and also having no problem wiping all these apes out. Like, yeah, she believes humans are the superior race here.
Yes. Which is cool from a movie perspective, because it's bombastic. It's awesome. It's the, you know, one rises up to fight the many kind of storyline. But at the same time, you're like, One human is going to take on an entire kingdom of apes by herself.
Yeah, but
like,
I'm,
that seems.
And you're also on Noah's side. Like, I feel like Noah does a good job. The character does a good job of winning you over to his side. Eagle Clan's a very peaceful clan. They're not attacking anyone. They're not doing anything. They had no part in any of this. So you're automatically on his side to save his people. You have Proximus over here who's doing all these, you know, he's enslaving people and doing these horrible things just to get into this vault so he can get this magical weaponry, which I think we all knew was going to be guns and shit. And then you've got May, who seems like this weakling who's just out there in the forest, but really she's planning to get technology for her own weaponry, like for her own people to be able to communicate with other humans, because they, you can tell they're planning a coordinated attack against the apes. That's what it seems like to me.
Yes.
You as
100%.
Well? 100%. I like that converging of ideas, because we get a movie that's its own movie, but you can see it setting up this bigger conflict slash world.
And I think for Noah's character specifically, it's a matter of, we're a peace-loving clan. We've now been enslaved. They now have to rise up in order to take Eagle Clan back and be what Eagle Clan is supposed to do. But at the same time, he has to partner with a human who you think is naive, who you think can't speak, and yet she's like freaking Luke Skywalker, Jedi Knight out there with the MacGyver skills, and it's just... that what she can do on her own tells you she's a very powerful human being, and what kind of training has she had? What lineage does she come from? And so there's this real uneasy tension between May and Noah and their relationship, which was really great, because I think it harkens back to the first movie when you had that, you know, early, you know, can I trust you ape human relationship with Caesar initially. So I think that was really well played. The scene at the end when they say goodbye for the last time in this movie, maybe not forever, that seemed very tense, especially when you see what's behind May's back.
I love that. I thought that was a great shot. I had this debate after we saw it, because the person I'm watching it with, they said, well, you know, I'm watching it, and her basically blowing everything up just shocked her, came out of nowhere kind of thing. I'm like, I don't think so. I mean, once you know she can talk, you already know she's, you know, manipulative. She's intelligent.
Yeah.
She's, this is a tactical solution to whatever her ills are. And it's the end game. I have no qualms whatsoever that she was always going to blow all of them up. And she didn't want to hurt Noah. I think she came to really respect and like Noah as well as Raka. But that was her plan. She really believes they are better than the apes, and the apes are going to destroy her people if she doesn't accomplish this goal, you know. So I thought that was always going to be. And so when she comes to that moment at the end where she comes back to Noah, and you see that, it was a really well done shot. Like, it wasn't
really well done,
overly focused on, and there wasn't any cheesy moment where she holds the gun and puts the gun away and all that other stuff. No, she just has her hand on it in case he does something, some kind of attack, right? In case he does something proactive instead of reactive, so she can react to it. But then, you know, she lets him be. She leaves. Now, what do you take that to mean? Do you take that to mean she trusts him, or she doesn't see him as a threat?
I think right now doesn't see him as a threat. She has what she needs to accomplish the mission. She understands that he is not going to follow her to wherever she's about to go. And I think it leaves enough opening for what that could look like in the future, as far as if they start to come through and humans become humans again and just shoot the shit out of everything, you know, does she then become this savior of the Eagle Clan, or is it truly there's going to be some backstabbing going on in the future? It gives the writers room for whatever the future may hold, which I think is really what you're supposed to do in these movies, of leave you guessing, you know, are they going to be friends? Are they going to be enemies? Come back in 2 years or 3 years.
Yeah, right. So do you have any opinion on her? Did you feel like she was a backstabber, or do you feel like that was always her plan? I mean, that was always her plan, but do you feel like she's a manipulative backstabber? Like, do you see her as a good guy or a bad guy?
I think that what's really great about Noah is he goes on this journey, right? Humans are bad. Humans are awful. Humans taunt us and come up from the valley. Mm-hmm. And then he spends that time with Raka and understands Caesar's teachings and learns a little bit about what the humans could be potentially, and then has to side with a human in order to save his people. So you get a real understanding of like what you're being told isn't necessarily what you should believe in. You should basically make up your own mind and your own decisions based on your own research and your own knowledge, right? Don't just be, you know, a lackey following some leader down the line. You know, really decide for yourself. And I think that's what May is also now coming to realize, is that she's been on this mission to find this tech, bring it back to the humans, do what she needs to do. But she's also understanding and learning and growing that, oh, maybe all apes aren't so bad. And maybe there is a way that we could exist together. And then just the fact that Noah hands her the Caesar icon, you know, from the top of the house, the window, mm-hmm. you know, from the first movie. Like, that was just a touching moment to say, like, hey, here's a symbol of our religion, our peace, our God, our leader, if you will. And I'm giving it to you. That's a bonding moment for May and Noah in that moment. And it's interesting to see what will happen because of that.
Can you explain that? Because I think a lot of people missed that whole symbol.
Yeah, so in the first movie, right, Caesar's brought home to a house. And for Caesar, that's like Caesar's safety zone, his safe space, because that's where Caesar was treated as not a thing, but, you know, a person, mm-hmm. if you will. And up in the window is where he lived, up in the attic. And he looked out that window, and the window had a very specific shape to it, almost like a four-leaf clover kind of. It's basically like two ovals crisscrossed to look like a cross inside of a circle. And that symbol is the symbol of Caesar. And so that symbol is now used in this new world to represent Caesar's teachings. So you actually see it painted on the shipyard in the kingdom and a few other places, and they carry it around as like a totem or token on their person. So gifting the gift of Caesar to somebody else, non-ape, that's something that's huge, because for the apes, it's everything.
It's absolutely huge. And at the at the end, we see that Noah is rebuilding his clan, you know, all of their structures, their ways. They're basically recreating their entire life. Meanwhile, you've got May going back to the secret installation. This is where it goes a little crazy sci-fi. And what they do at this ending is they use this technology that she has retrieved to rejigger the satellites, essentially, get them reactivated so they can reach out to another human clan, or at least it seems human. I would love if this was if this is a ploy and it's actually a bunch of apes who figured this technology out, and they're like, hey man, yeah, come meet us. We're all good. Meet us in the middle of the valley, you know, and then they just attack them or something. But it seems like it's a human clan. What did you think about the ending? Did you like this little twist?
Yeah. I mean, when you think about where the apes all started, right, it was about an astronaut originally, right? Charlton Heston back in the day. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about the Tim Burton movie in 2001, but at the end of the day, space is a big thing with the Planet of the Apes concepts. And so what they've done here is they've opened up the ability. People might think that they're communicating with other humans on Earth, but you remember Noah goes and finds this telescope during the course of the movie. And at the end of the movie, he brings, you know, his friends to the telescope so that they can look again through the telescope and see what's out there, what's up there. And we don't see what's up there. And the fact that they're programming radio telescopes at this installation for the humans, one might think that they're talking to humans that may have gotten away and escaped into space, mm-hmm. living on space stations or some kind of ark kind of ship or whatever. So there very well could be humans living in space. And that's what Noah sees when Noah looks through the telescope and who the humans may be communicating with. But you don't know.
That was the one I understood the whole May aspect of the storyline. When he looks through the telescope, I'm like, what is he looking at again? And that's your theory, that it's people that are living on a space station or something like that, that are basically being signaled, you can come back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's basically like, it's the 100, unfortunately.
It's the 100. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Or they're talking to another planet, right? Like some people were saying, like, are they actually on our Earth versus could they be on a different Earth? And it's like, well, it's been a while. So, I mean, they could have had humans travel or apes travel or, you know, anything is possible.
Much. I think that's too
but
much.
It gets hokey. So yeah. I like the idea that there's humans living in space trying to communicate with the ground, and the ground's mission was to basically reestablish communication. And when communication was reestablished, we could come home.
And one last thing, especially with the production, look, I give Westball a lot of credit. I think there was a lot that he had to live up to make this movie work. I think trying to compete with, especially the Matt Reeves versions of the films, that's very hard to do. Those films are seen as really top tier sci-fi cinema. And I think he does a very good job, right? I think he does a good job of reinventing this world and kind of getting us focused on a first story to lead us into a new trilogy of films, potentially. And also, this could end here and I'd be fine. I like the idea of wondering what could happen next. So that doesn't bother me at all.
And I love what Wes does here is a really great job of making you love an apes movie without Andy Serkis, without Caesar.
Yeah. And that's hard to do. That was hard to do.
Caesar's felt, but you don't need Caesar for these movies to work. And this movie works in a lot of ways. And it feels like it's truly part of those three movies from Matt Reeves and company. It doesn't feel like it was completely janky like Tim Burton's version.
What I find most fascinating about this entire film is, I think it was like $160 million budget, right? So it doesn't need to make crazy amount of money to justify a sequel worldwide. So, I think it already did pretty close to its budget opening weekend worldwide. So it's in good footing. What I love about it is I've seen movies that cost double that. Look at Ant-Man, right? The last Ant-Man cost $300 some million. And the effects, I think, mostly look terrible. The head in the jar looked ridiculous.
Yes, MODOK.
Yeah, MODOK looked horrible. I mean, there's just so much that's bad there. But here, there's so much CGI. I had a hard time deciphering what was CGI and what wasn't. A lot of the time, you could and I saw it in IMAX, which makes it a lot easier to point out defects, right?
Oh, yeah.
And walking out of the theater, I'm like, maybe apes can talk. Who knew? Or monkeys, depending on your perspective.
Yeah. Or orangutans.
Or orangutans. But I or absolutely
eagles, or falcons or hawks.
Yeah. I don't know how many of those are real or digital. I'm sure they're mostly digital. It looks fantastic. The CGI is absolutely phenomenal. I was absolutely overwhelmed with how amazing the CGI was, especially for how much there is in this movie and what the budget was.
And I feel bad because there were two janky moments that I literally were like, they really stood out as janky because the CGI is that good. But it's like when it's that good and you see the flaw is definitely like show. Mm-hmm. And I think the two that came to mind were when he's fixing the electro spear, his arm just does something weird when he goes to the back of the spear. And it looks like the arm is like in a different layer than the rest of the the frame.
I didn't catch that one.
And then when Proximus climbs up onto the scaffolding for the first time to give the speech, like his movements around the scaffolding are just kind of like, you can't do that even as a really good gymnast. That's no. that doesn't bend that way.
No. Which what's funny about that, and I caught that one too. That one did stand out to me. But earlier, at the very beginning of the movie, they have this back and forth where they're jumping from cliffside to cliffside trying to get the eggs and whatnot.
Gorgeous opening.
Yes. And I'm like, do the same kind of movements, man. It would have looked great. Like that looked phenomenal. Absolutely amazing.
You can hide it though too because you have all the foliage and stuff versus the open scaffolding.
But. Sure. So overall, big. I know we said seven and a half, but this is the start of what I hope to be two more great films.
Yeah, and I would say I could watch this one again. I don't know if I'd sit in the theater again because it is lofty at like 2 hours and 20 minutes.
It was pretty heavy. Yep.
Yeah, which is you know, Troy old adage, 20 minutes too long, and it was 20 minutes too long. There is some stuff that could be shaved.
Absolutely.
But overall, like I would totally sit down and watch this again. Like you could totally watch the three movies and then add this one into that mix.
Absolutely. Anything you want to say in parting on Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes?
Go see it. Definitely go see it in a theater. Go see it in IMAX or Dolby Cinema. Don't cheap out for the small screen. It's worth the big view.
Absolutely. And that's it for this episode. Remember, the next time you head to a theater or stream comfortably on your couch, but not this movie, go see it in a theater. By God. Bye, popcorn.
On cable.
Not cable.
Coming back, people.
Bye, popcorn.